to the next case, United States v. Richardson. Mr. Stevens?
Good morning. Walter Richardson committed a murder in 1999 and was sent to Lake County Jail for the purposes of being tried in state court. While he was in state court, he and two of the inmates, among others, concocted a scheme to try to eliminate witnesses against him in the state court proceeding. The purpose of this appeal, the people that are substantial that he talked to in the Lake County Jail are Jones and Wolf. Wolf eventually became a government informant, and Jones eventually was charged as a co-conspirator. Counts one and three, charged Mr. Richardson with the use of the mails in furtherance of a murder for hire. The issue that I've raised in this is whether there was, in fact, the compensation element of a murder for hire. Now, the evidence shows that Walter Richardson talked to Curtis Jones. He says, "I'll give you $500 to $1,000 if you'll get a gun for this murder." Jones says, "I told him I wasn't worried about the money." Jones did not in any way indicate that he accepted that offer. That alone is sufficient for this court to reverse the convictions as to counts one and three, because there was no other discussion of hiring anybody prior to the mailings in December of 2001. All of the mailings occurred.
$1,000 seems like an unusually high price for a gun.
Certainly, I would concede.
Sounds like it might include compensation for other forms of services rendered.
It may well include compensation for other forms, but there was no testimony and any inference that a jury might have tried to draw that this was in exchange for some services would be totally unsupported by the evidence. You simply have $1,000. You're not talking about what kind of gun. You're not talking about the source of the gun. More importantly, Jones said, "I told him I wasn't worried about the money. There was no meeting of the minds." Now, the government's theory, as set forth in their brief,
is actually an old saw in antitrust. Whether if somebody sold a rabbit's foot for $100 to go with something, that should be deemed part of the price of the thing to which it was tied. The usual answer is yes, because rabbit's feet don't sell for $100 in the market. One would think the same thing with a gun. Why not?
Well, there's no evidence about what the street price of guns would be. In fact, there were talk of several hundred, $500 that they were willing to pay for certain guns. They were not able to get guns for those kinds of sums. So it certainly is not clear in the evidence that $1,000 was an unreasonable amount to pay for a gun. The government's theory with regard to the issue of compensation is that Jones had culpability as an accessory to the murder by virtue of the fact that he was going to get a gun, because that's the only evidence at that point that there was as to his involvement, was to get the gun. There was no evidence that he was going to be a trigger man or participate in any other way at that point. If you accept the government's theory, then you can get to some absurd results, because, for example, I could tell someone, "I want to kill my boss. I'll pay you $20 to drive me down to the store where he works." Clearly that person has some criminal liability as an accessory, but I'm the one committing the murder. Is that a murder for hire? That's clearly not what the statute was intended to prohibit. Payment to an accomplice is not compensation for a murder. And in fact, the statute says, "With the intent that a murder be committed as consideration for the receipt of anything of pecuniary value." The commission of the murder is for pecuniary value. And that's what makes the murder for hire, not the fact that somebody did something in furtherance and was paid. The mailings occurred in December of 2000. the first discussions as to any compensation did not occur until January of 2001. The mailings could not have been in with the intent that there be a murder for hire. Counts 1 and 3 must fall. Counts 2 and 4 deal with a separate issue, and that is the use of a telephone wholly intrastate in the commission or in furtherance of the commission of a murder for hire. And there are two issues involving those counts. The first, again, is the issue of compensation. And as I argued in my brief, there was no evidence that anyone came to any agreement for the payment to the ATF agent for the commission of the murder. The evidence was that the confidential informant who was acting as a government agent said, "I'm going to let him have the gun," and Richardson said, "Okay." At a later point, the agent asked, "Am I going to get compensated? I'd like to get $500 because I've got my eye on a gun." Richardson says, "You're going to get that and more. We're going to be partners when this is all over." And he goes on to describe a crime spree. The only interpretation in the, that you can come to from the evidence is that Richardson contemplated that he, Wolf, and the agent were going to become partners in crime once he was released as a result of the loss of these witnesses and his not being able to be prosecuted successfully by the state. And it's my position that that is not compensation. That is not a murder for hire. A future agreement that, hey, we're going to be partners, is not a consideration.
Why not? If I say, when I get out of jail, I'm going to form a business to sell refrigerators, and I'll give you a 25% equity interest in that business. Why wouldn't the promise of a 25% equity interest in the business be compensation?
I think it depends, Ed, on on the terms of the agreement.
The terms are the ones I just stated.
The terms are, I will give you a 25% equity interest in the business. A 25% equity interest in the business certainly is something that has pecuniary value. And if the intent is, in payment for what you do, I'm going to cut you a slice of my business, irrespective of your having to be associated with the business, irrespective of your having to provide any further services, irrespective of you're doing anything further other than the act that I'm cutting you a 25%, then that's compensation. If the agreement is, we're going to be partners, we're going to equally share the work, we're going to equally share the proceeds, that's a different circumstance, because it doesn't have value until the person renders additional services. It is not a thing of pecuniary value until such time as we do further work. And that's how I would distinguish the two. In this case, Agent Molina, of course, you're shaking your head, Judge. Is there,
there's an option value whether or not the business has been formed. But for the fact that the venture was illegal, that is, shares to be issued in businesses to be formed have positive value. They can trade on the New York Stock Exchange. That's one reason why shares of bankrupt corporations trade at a positive price.
In this case, though, Judge, we're talking about as you characterize it, an illegal venture which has no value until an illegal act is done. It can't be something of economic value or pecuniary value because it's illegal. There is no cash value to it. There is no expectation of cash value.
No, it just can't be traded above board.
But I would suggest that it can't even be traded under the table, so to speak.
If Al Capone had said, I'll give you a 1% interest in my business ventures here in Chicago, that would have traded under the table, of course, for a large positive price.
The difference is, Your Honor, this is more akin to Al Capone saying, come rob a bank with me and we'll split the proceeds. There is no value until the additional act is committed, and that requires the work of both parties. The pecuniary value does not happen until such time as additional services or additional efforts happen. It's not necessary, though, for me to depend on the issue of compensation, because statute also requires that there be an interstate commerce connection, and I notice I'm into my rebuttal time, so I will try to summarize this quickly. Lopez has given us basically a framework to look at interstate commerce issues. First, we can look at the channels of interstate commerce. Second, we can look at the instrumentalities of interstate commerce. And third, we can look at the activities that substantially affect interstate commerce. The Sixth Circuit case cited in my brief looked at the use of the channels of interstate commerce. The Fifth Circuit took a different position and looked at the instrumentalities of interstate commerce. And you get to different points depending on how you read the statute. The statute requires that there must be a use of a facility in interstate or foreign commerce with the intent that a murder for hire be committed. The Sixth Circuit has said that there is a difference between a facility of interstate commerce and a facility in interstate commerce. A facility of interstate commerce is one that operates across state lines but is not necessarily acting in interstate commerce at the time of the offense. On the other hand, a facility in interstate commerce is one that there must be, as the Sixth Circuit found, some transaction that crosses state lines in connection with the offense. I think the Sixth Circuit analysis is certainly more proper. The Fifth Circuit looked at the statute and says, well, there's no difference between in interstate commerce and of interstate commerce. But the telling point, I think, is to look at the definitions in Section B of 1958. And that section says a facility of interstate commerce, facility of interstate commerce, includes a means of transportation or communication. A means of transportation or communication. Now, if you look at the statute says whoever travels in interstate or foreign commerce, and then it goes on to talk about or uses a facility. That section would not be necessary if in interstate commerce and of interstate commerce meant the same thing. Because the definition says a means of transportation is sufficient to be able to violate the statute. And it would not be necessary then to travel in interstate commerce. That would that makes the first section of the statute then superfluous. Congress in its legislative history said that an interstate telephone call is sufficient to trigger federal jurisdiction. Congress legislative history said we don't intend to encompass all of these kinds of crimes or even most of these kinds of crimes. And if in fact the Fifth Circuit's interpretation is correct, then we would encompass all murders for hire. Let me give you the correct reading of the statute, interlineating as Congress intended. Whoever uses any facility of interstate commerce in interstate or foreign commerce with the intent that a murder be committed is syntactically what Congress meant. And I will reserve then the rest of my time for rebuttal.
All right, thank you, Stephen. Ms. Benson?
May it please the court and counsel, regarding the first issue regarding the consideration between, between Walter Richardson and Curtis Jones. Now, the background is that these two individuals were incarcerated together for quite a while. Mr. Jones facing attempted murder charges and Mr. Richardson incarcerated for the murder there at the Lake County Jail. I believe that the conversations between Mr. Jones and Mr. Richardson and Mr. Jones' response to that, as the court picked up on, indicated desire to do more than just supply a firearm. I don't believe in any way, shape, or form that Mr. Jones' response that I'll do this for somewhere, it seems to be 700 to 1,000 or 500 to 1,000, but regardless, that was just to supply a firearm. Because as the jury came to find out later on, there was a tape recording made of Mr. Jones at the White Castle with the confidential informant. And if there was any doubt that when Mr. Jones talked to Mr. Richardson in the jail about whether or not he was up for the crime, and the jury certainly, I think, could have inferred that from the very language of Mr. Jones' response, or the large dollar amount for the offer. Mr. Jones confirmed that in an undercover tape recording when he was specifically asked by Mr. Wolf, not only was Mr. Jones trying to get guns, because in a three-way conversation, Mr. Jones called someone to get a gun, and that individual was trying to get it. But also, Mr. Wolf asked Jones specifically, are you up for the whole thing? Yeah, I'm down for it. That, certainly the jury had the right to consider that in attempting to determine what Mr. Jones' involvement was going to be at the time him and Mr. Richardson talked in the jail. Mr. Richardson made the offer of between $700 to $1,000. Mr. Jones indicated that he was willing to become involved in this plan, and that the money, his exact wording was, this was a friend of mine, I didn't want to charge him, but I was offered money. Mr. Jones never said, no, I don't want your money, I will do this for free. Mr. Jones' response could have meant a lot of different things. Number one, how was the payment going to be made? Number two, when it was going to be made? Or number three, was it going to be something else in addition to the payment? So he did not decline the payment. And the statute itself says that it merely has to be the promise to pay the money as consideration for the receipt of, or as consideration for a promise or agreement to pay. Clearly, Mr. Richardson promised the money to Jones. He told him straight up. And as the tapes revealed throughout the conversations, Mr. Jones was actively trying to get a firearm. So Mr. Richardson did promise to Mr. Jones, while they both were incarcerated at the Lake County Jail, that in fact, you'll get something when my witnesses are gone. Therefore, the mailings, Mr. Jones talked about after he got out of jail, the coded letters that were sent to him, one being a letter written in code.
What did he buy from Jones?
Richardson bought from Jones? He bought the promise that Mr. Jones was going to assist him in getting rid of the witnesses, either through one, helping out in the direct murder, or two, supplying anything, including a firearm, that might be necessary to effect.
Those two would be very different. And if I'm planning to murder somebody by running him down in the street in an automobile, and I go to an auto dealer and buy a car at the market price of a car, have I committed the crime of murder for hire? Because I paid the auto dealer a sum of money to give me an instrument that I then used in committing a murder.
I would say no, you have not. The auto dealer has no idea as to what's going to be done with the car. Plus, there's no the car can be used for multiple purposes. You have to realize,
guns can be used for purposes other than committing murder.
Well, in this case, though, Mr. Richardson's statement was he needed to get rid of the witnesses. You couple that statement with get me a gun, Mr. Richardson was locked up. He couldn't have shot anybody. So, Mr. Wolf's testimony was that they sat around the jail. Mr. Richardson, Mr. Wolf, and Mr. Jones went through all the discoveries the state of Indiana provided, replayed their trial, and realized the only way for Richardson to get out of this was to get rid of the witnesses. It's only in that context, Judge, that Mr. Richardson tells Jones, I'll pay you $500 to $1,000, you know, to do this for me when you get out. And actually the plan was to bond people out first and they would help each other. That didn't materialize. But clearly, Mr. Jones didn't run away after he got out. He became involved and made phone calls and even admitted that he was down for the whole thing, which I suggest to the court shows that he was down right from the beginning. And that's why there was this large offer of payment. As the exhibit to reveal the trial, the price of the guns on the street were relatively cheap, between $100 and $200, maybe $300 at the most. That's not what was offered. So we believe clearly that the initial offer was an offer for Mr. Jones to either supply the firearm or to, knowing that a murder was going to be committed, or to actually be involved in the murder himself, as he ultimately explained in the tape-recorded conversation after he was released. And the two letters that were sent followed that conversation from the jail. Mr. Jones bonded out. He received one letter in code and then received the decoding letter, which is further evidence of Mr. Richardson's intent in the agreement that Mr. Jones and Mr. Richardson had at the time they were incarcerated together. Additionally, once Mr. Jones is out, as well as Mr. Wolf bonding out, Mr. Wolf acting as the CI, there were numerous conversations between Walter Richardson, Curtis Jones, and the confidence informant, Mr. Wolf. And during the course of those conversations, as counsel articulated, an inquiry was made by the undercover officer, Joseph Molina, about, you know, I need to get something out of this. And eventually, a couple things came up. Number one, Exhibit 26P of the government's brief indicates that Richardson did promise to pay Agent Molina at least $500 and or some guns, but also this talk, as the court pointed out, of some future burglary, I believe it was in Tennessee, that Richardson said he had someone on the inside. So clearly this isn't some speculative, say, hey, look, when we get out, we might just go do something. Richardson already had a place picked out, and that was a very concrete promise to share those proceeds from a specific burglary upon his release. It wasn't something so nebulous or so far out there as to not to have any idea what was going to happen. I don't believe that would fit within the parameters of the statute, and that would be making the statute too broad. But regardless of this burglary in Tennessee, he offered Molina the $500. And what's interesting is certainly that offer to Agent Molina doesn't constitute a conspiracy. But Agent Molina talked to Walter Richardson's wife, who pled guilty to a conspiracy to commit murder for hire and cooperated with the government. Immediately after this conversation between Walter Richardson and Molina, when Molina says, what am I going to get? $500 and maybe some guns. Molina talks to Walter Richardson's wife, who's out on bond in the state case. Molina tells him, look, I'm not doing this for free. I'm going to be compensated. You know that? And this is with Wolf, the CI on the phone. She goes, yeah, I understand. I can't help you out, but I understand Billy, that's Walter Richardson's going to take care of you. She knows that Richardson is going to pay Molina. She then proceeds to drive Molina around to all the places where the witnesses live, and then points out how you can get them. Clearly, at that point, she knew Walter Richardson was paying for the murder. Walter Richardson knew his wife was doing this. Walter Richardson was at least conspiring with his wife at that time. And I argue also with Jones. Additionally, before anybody ever got out of jail, Walter Richardson sent these two letters to his wife, to someone asking her to give these to someone named Dice. Dice was another person who had previously been incarcerated with the defendants. And in those letters, Walter Richardson wrote to his wife, and she read those letters. Her testimony was she knew what the contents were of those letters, and the letters were telling Dice to, hey, help me get the witnesses, and I'll make it up to you any way you want. So to say that Jennifer Richardson didn't really know the full scope of this when she was driving Agent Molina around is not accurate. She clearly knew right out of the box that her husband wanted the witnesses killed. She was willing to assist in that and subsequently pled guilty to that endeavor. Regarding the interstate call, I'm not going to sit here and pretend to attempt to be either more intellectual or more articulate than the en banc opinion in Merrick. I think they did an absolutely tremendous job of analyzing what the statute was. and I believe that their reasoning is very sound. They looked at several factors. They looked at, first of all, the grammatical structure of the statute in terms of what the phrase in interstate commerce was modifying. I think they made a reasonable determination, an accurate determination, that it modifies facility, not use. Additionally, they looked to subsection B2, which clearly uses the phrase of interstate commerce. That appears to maybe create some type of ambiguity, but I suggest to you that it doesn't. Because if you read those section B and section A in conjunction with the legislative history clearly uses those two terms interchangeably. As a matter of fact, I believe they used the term of interstate commerce 3 or 4 times in the legislative history and used the term in interstate commerce only once. But if you look at the legislative history when they're trying to decide the, or talk about the scope of the statute, they use the term of interstate commerce. Additionally, the title itself, use of interstate commerce facilities in the commission of murder for hire. It doesn't say interstate use of facilities. It says use of interstate commerce facilities. And certainly, as the court's well aware, they can construe all of those different portions of the statute to help to determine its intent. There was some talk in one of the cases that this might make the statute overly broad if we just applied it to, as was argued in the Merritt case, that it would apply to every murder for hire. Well, as the sparseness of case law indicates on it, there are very few murders for hire. There simply aren't that many of them that ever occurred. The tragedy may be most murders are committed for free or for the pecuniary gain of the person committing the murder themselves, not as payment. But clearly, we believe that the case, the en banc decision in Merrick, clearly is an extremely well-reasoned opinion, and we urge this court to adopt that reasoning in this circuit as the proper interpretation of the statute. There are no other questions. I've step down.
All right, thank you. Stephen? If Walter Richardson were charged with use of the mail and use of the telephone in a commission of a murder, I would have a hard time standing up here making an argument. He's been accused of use of those facilities in a murder for hire. What I'm asking this court to hold is that compensation in a murder for hire, Congress meant compensation paid to the hitman, the person committing the murder, and not to some accessory for some ancillary act, which, while they may have criminal responsibility for the murder, is not the act of murder itself. The compensation, as referred to by Congress, although there are no cases that I've been able to find, should be compensation to the what's commonly known as a hitman. With regard to the issue of interstate commerce, clearly every facility in interstate commerce is a facility of interstate commerce. The converse is not true, and that's why Congress said, or that's why the Senate report said, that interstate telephone calls are sufficient to trigger federal jurisdiction. Facility of interstate commerce is different from a facility in interstate commerce, and this statute requires a facility in interstate commerce.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Benson. The case is taken under